special President's Day edition of Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheim. We're starting off today's show with a look at the women beside the Commander-in-Chief. Most people have heard about the more notable first ladies like Mary Todd Lincoln and Jackie Kennedy, as well as Betty Ford. But today, we're going to look at the lives of the lesser-known first ladies and see how they have influenced the culture of the day. In a year-long feature series, C-SPAN co-president and CEO and on-air host Susan Swain, along with executive producer Mark Farkas and a team of historians, explored the personal lives of the nation's first ladies. Following the feature's broadcast on C-SPAN, Ms. Swain transcribed the series into a book of the same name. Susan and Mark join us now from Washington, D.C. to talk about some of these women, especially those you may not know too much about. Susan Swain, Mark Farkas, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Susan, this project was the first comprehensive look at all of the first ladies. One of the only other representations of these women is in the Smithsonian, and that's dedicated to the outfits they wore to various events. Why do you think no one has taken on this task before?
Well, because their husbands really take all the oxygen out of the room in most cases in the story of American history. And that was really how the project had its genesis. We have worked for many years with a presidential historian named Richard Norton Smith. He has himself been the executive director, starting executive director of five presidential libraries. And he's also a wonderful storyteller. He lobbied us after we did two big projects on presidential history. You've got to look at these ladies. There's so much here that hasn't been told. And he was successful. He made us read a few biographies and invited us to a few panel sessions where some of the women were talked about. And we bought into it. And then we started this project where Mark and his team did something which has really been one of the joys of this. They sent a videographer out to almost every historic site around the country, large and small, associated with the first ladies, and captured elements of their biography on video, and then we put it all on our website. So this will stand for the ages as a central repository where people who want to learn more about these women can go.
Mark, these women's lives were completely changed when their husbands were elected. In the words of former President Richard Nixon's wife, Pat, quote, "Being a first lady is the hardest unpaid job in the world," end quote. Can you talk about the service and sacrifice of the first ladies that's often mentioned throughout the series?
It's one of the fascinating things that you learn as you go around the country to these sites and learn about them and walk in their footsteps. And when you go to the White House, is that one of the common themes, especially in the 19th century, is this the sense of loss that first ladies have. Children are dying. And it happens to not just first ladies. It happens to all of us. Every family suffers some type of loss. But for someone to have to deal with that when they're in the fishbowl that is the White House, I think, complicates it. It opens it up to the whole country. And it makes their lives, I mean, it's, didn't Martha Washington call it a gilded cage? Mm. So it's complicated. But that was one of the fascinating things, was really looking at their private lives as they lived in this very public fishbowl.
Grace Coolidge had a wonderful quote that we used in her chapter, talking about this duality that they had to live, the public first lady and the private person. She said it was I and yet not I, almost an out-of-body experience, because everything that they did, and this happened very early on in the presidency, people were sitting in trees to catch a glimpse of Martha Washington go by. So they always had to be this larger public self, and it is a trial, and they are not the politicians in the family, but they're part of the family business, and their husband's success is their family's success. So many of them did what they could to support the family business, and there are a few presidents who would not be president were it not for the ambitions of the first lady.
And some of the ladies that embraced the role, people know about Abigail Adams, Jackie Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, but this series gives equal attention to all 45 first ladies. Let's talk about some of the less well-known women who lived in the White House, starting with the youngest first lady, Frances Cleveland. In her episode, she's referred to as the Jackie Kennedy of her day. Tell us why that is and what else we might not know about her.
Well, her nickname was Frank, and she, her husband was actually a bachelor when he came into the White House, and there was all this speculation about who his bride might be. And in fact, many people in the press thought it was going to be Francis's mother, because there is a 27-year age difference between Frances Cleveland and her husband, the president. But he was her guardian. Her father died when she was very young. The president and her father had been partners in business, and he became her guardian, and he really took great care of her and her mother throughout their life and lavished lots of attention on her, was always sending her flowers when she went to college, and invited her to go campaigning with him when he was running for governor in the state. He was earlier a mayor, and she'd been involved in following some of that as a young woman. But in fact, his intentions were much larger than that, because really immediately after she graduated from college, he proposed.
And he figured the best way to guard her would be to marry her.
That's right. So at the age of 22, she was married in a White House wedding ceremony that just captured the public's attention. John Philip Sousa was the orchestra leader at the wedding ceremony at the White House. They went away on a vacation to Deep Creek Lake, which isn't too far from Pittsburgh, and tried to escape the hordes of press people that wanted to follow them because she was such a sensation. She was a fashion trend center, and this was also the time when newspapers were highly competitive, and they were all chasing after the Frances Cleveland stories, and she supplied them with many. The other thing that, a couple of other things, well, one on just the little notation side, she, in the second, in between first and second terms, theirs is the only non-sequential presidency, but during the hiatus when they lived in New York, she gave birth to her first child, whose name was Ruth, and again, this, it was so popular in the press, it was Baby Ruth, and the candy company named the Baby Ruth candy bar after her, which we're still eating today. So that's a little remnant of that administration that's still part of our popular culture.
But it's also very interesting when they have the children and they go back for their second term. It's a completely different experience for them. They start closing down the White House. The press is so interested in Baby Ruth and the family that the White House, which before then had been open up to the public, they start closing it down. And so it is an example of a very, very popular first lady, but almost too popular, and wasn't really thrilled. And I think, you know, the first time they were defeated, she said, keep everything the same, we'll be back in 4 years. I think that second time when they left, they were ready to leave.
I will say one thing we should also know. She was complicit in a cover-up. The president got cancer of the mouth, the jaw. He was a big cigar smoker, and he got cancer of the mouth, and you can't imagine this happening. It couldn't happen today. But they secreted him off the coastline in a boat and did an operation where they removed part of his jaw, and Francis was part of the cover-up to not let the public know about that.
And the whole reason was the country was going through a terrible recession, borderline depression, and they thought that if the news of President Cleveland's cancer got out, it would drive the markets down even further.
Amazing story. Well, since this is a news station, let's talk about the first lady with journalistic aspirations, Florence Harding. She was deeply involved with her husband's newspaper and adept at handling the media, and she was also the first lady to vote. But her husband wasn't the most faithful of spouses, and his career was riddled with scandal. Being an outspoken and ambitious personality, what legacy do you think Florence leaves behind in the White House?
Well, you know, in my opinion, when you take a look at some of the great footage, it's the last great front porch campaign, and Florence Harding is out there shaking hands. Even though she's pretty ill from time to time, she's shaking hands along there with Warren. So she really is one of these first ladies who knows how to be a politician and knows when she needed to play the role of the faithful wife of Warren Harding. So she was doing a lot of interviews with magazines and newspapers. Most of the magazines were women's magazines. And as you mentioned, she's the first lady in an election where women are allowed to vote. The 19th Amendment has passed. And in 1920, I think about 8 million women vote. And so she plays a key role in the campaign. And I think that's one of her legacies, is helping him get elected.
She also started what has become a part of politics today, bringing Hollywood into the campaign. The movies were becoming enormously popular in American society, and they made movie stars like Al Jolson and Lillian Gish part of their campaign effort. They showed movies in the White House, and they really created this sense of celebrity. And Florence was an incredible marketer of her husband, and she really knew how to play on all of this. She used photography extensively. They had a dog that they used in many of the photographs. And just as we love cat pictures on the internet today, those puppy pictures were very popular with the American public back in the Harding administration.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with the people behind the series First Ladies, C-SPAN co-president and CEO, as well as on-air host Susan Swain, along with executive producer Mark Farkas. And we're talking about some of the lesser known First Ladies, and Pennsylvania's only First Lady, Harriet Lane, has a very interesting story. She was the niece of James Buchanan, not his wife, but his niece. What can you tell us about this Mercersburg native?
Yes, about 150 miles from Pittsburgh, Mercersburg, her hometown. And her parents died when she was 8 or 9 years old, and her uncle took her in, and other nieces and nephews as well, helped to raise them. He was pretty wealthy, and so he gave them a good life. He was at one point appointed ambassador to Great Britain, and he took Harriet along with him, and she was a sensation. She met the Queen, and she apparently charmed the Queen, so much so that the Prince came to visit when they were in office, and that was a really big coup for the White House at that time. Harriet was very young, and she was very popular with the public. Unfortunately, the country was on its inexorable slide toward the Civil War. And even though the White House entertained greatly, and Harriet had twice a week dinners trying to bring factions together, there was really no saving the Republic by that point. And it was a failed presidency, although it was a very popular First Lady in Harriet Lane. What I love about Harriet Lane is not so much even the years she was in the White House, but what she did after she left the White House. She was married afterwards because, again, she was quite young. And she had two children. And sadly, both of her sons and her husband died by the time she was in her 50s. So she moved back to Washington. And she was really very involved with all the White Houses. Every time they had state dinners, they would invite her. She was enormously popular. But she did so much good. She started the a home for invalid children, which is still today part of Johns Hopkins Hospital. And she also gave her art collection to the Smithsonian, and it became the basis for our National Gallery. She was involved with the creation of St. Albans School, where presidential children often matriculate. So she was really a contributor throughout the post-White House years. And that is one of the other things about the stories of these First Ladies. It's how they used their celebrity when they left the White House to continue to follow causes that they were interested in that is so much a part of their stories.
First Lady Sarah Polk, the wife of our 11th president, James K. Polk, is described as elegant and gracious and was the first to host Thanksgiving dinner at the White House. She was also her husband's campaign manager in Tennessee. And there's a story about how she helped James Polk while he was in office, but too ill to work. What can you tell us about Sarah's involvement with her husband's presidency?
Well, she was a politician of the first order for women of her age, very, very unusual. In fact, what I love about their story is that Andrew Jackson was the matchmaker between Sarah and James Polk, and she told him she would only marry him if he would run for office, and he did. He had a very successful career in Washington. He was Speaker of the House, and he never expected to be president. He was really our first dark horse candidate, and it was an unexpected thing that brought them there, but then she was very much a partner. Unusual for women of her time, she shared an office with him. She was his sounding board. Franklin Pierce told President Polk he would rather talk politics with Sarah than he would with the president because she knew so much. She would sit in on congressional debates. She clipped newspaper articles for him and made sure that he had them, would listen to his speeches beforehand. So quintessential political partner at a time when that just wasn't very much done among women in general. And it was not really repeated by First Ladies for a long time. If I can do a sidebar on this,
sure.
The stories of the First Ladies are really also the stories of the development of American women in society. So the very earliest first ladies were very much involved in revolutionary causes, and they were ardent about the founding of the country and very much involved. But once the country became successful, the men were much more interested in their wives. These are, you know, upper class, of course, their wives not doing any work and bringing servants into the house. And they didn't really have very much education for a long while. And then you start to see that change, and you start to see women getting involved in the spheres that they were allowed to in their society, women's issues, like the temperance movement and the like. And then it progresses from there. So as we follow the course of these White Houses, you also see the change in American society. So Sarah Polk stayed within her sphere for the most part, but she also pushed the envelope by being such a political partner with her husband. She managed his congressional campaigns, and she couldn't do that when he was elected president, because in those days you actually didn't campaign for president. It was considered unseemly.
But you're right, Paul. You know, he only lived 3 months after leaving the White House, so she was a caretaker of his. And the very interesting thing is, not only a caretaker of him at his end, at the end of his life, but she lived to be 88. And the Polk Place home in Tennessee is just a shrine to James Polk. And so that's also one of the roles that several of these women play after the White House years, is really taking up the cause of how their husband will be remembered. And Sarah Polk was a political partner during their lifetime and really took care of his legacy afterwards.
Also worth noting that the Polks were slave owners and yep. very much bought into the culture of slavery. So this is not all a hearts and roses story. This is, you know, this is warts and all American history here. And these women have complex stories and complex lives.
Well, it's really a reflection of the time. And one of the things, you know, the very first program we learn about Martha Washington is not only that she is setting precedent like George Washington, but that when, as First Lady, living in Philadelphia, one of her slaves, Oney Judge, escaped, and never returned. And so they are complex people. They're reflections of their time, and some of them are really ahead of their time as well.
Well, we have one more story we want to get to before we wrap up. And of course, across the country right now, young girls are fundraising for their troops, selling Girl Scout cookies. One First Lady, Lou Hoover, first had the idea for the cookie sale, and Lou also had a unique college degree. So tell us more about the wife of Herbert Hoover and her time in the White House.
Well, I'll start, and Mark can pick up the story, because she is such an interesting woman. The Hoovers, I thought, were a bit like Zelig. They seem to be at the most interesting parts in global history at the times that they were happening. They got married and went to China, and they were there during the Boxer Rebellion and actually set up barricades to help protect the Westerners as the Boxer Rebellion was being carried out all around them. They were in Europe after the war and helped set up the relief effort there. She was the first woman in the United States to get a college degree in geology. That's actually how they met. They went to Stanford together. And when he proposed, he took her around the world to his mining sites where he was working as an executive. And so they came to the White House without very much political experience, but with a lot of international exposure. And that lack of political experience ended up being a challenge for Lou Hoover.
Well, and it's an example, I think, of some couples are opposites. One of them is very outgoing, and the other one, I mean, James Madison was not very outgoing. Dolly Madison was, and so she really helped him in that way. Lou Hoover and Herbert Hoover have been described as sort of two sides of the same coin, both incredibly brilliant, but neither one particularly politically attuned to how, I mean, I'm not sure anyone could have gotten us out of the Depression, but you mentioned the Girl Scouts. That was part of a big volunteer effort in the 4-H clubs. The volunteerism during the Depression was the way the Hoovers were taking a look at it. But it's also really interesting when you take a look at the time period. Again, reflecting the time period is the technology. And right at that time, you've got the talkies. You've got radio. And Lou Hoover, in our program, we show a very, very, one of the very earliest forms of a photo op. And she's there talking with Girl Scouts, trying to really appeal to people around the country to help out through the Girl Scouts, the people who were so hard-pressed with the Depression.
Very interesting. And certainly one of the more interesting aspects of our President's Day special, our look at First Ladies, and we've been talking with the people involved with the First Ladies series on C-SPAN. C-SPAN co-president and CEO, on-air host Susan Swain, along with executive producer Mark Farkas. We thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Paul, thanks so much, and happy President's Day.
Thank you so much for having us on, Paul.
You're welcome. Happy President's Day to you, too. And we'll have more of our President's Day special on Essential Pittsburgh. This is 90.5 WESA.